Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe-Gazette for November 1, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. On the front page today, the lead article relates to the war in the Middle East. The headline, Israel Hits Refugee Camp. Military continues its ground invasion to seek Hamas militants. A barrage of Israeli airstrikes leveled apartment buildings in a refugee camp near Gaza City on Tuesday, and footage showed rescuers pulling men, women, and children out of the rubble. Israel claimed the strike destroyed a Hamas command center set up in civilian houses and a network of tunnels underneath. The toll from the strikes in Jabalia camp was not immediately known. The Israeli military said a large number of Hamas militants were killed, including the commander overseeing their operations in northern Gaza. The director of the nearby hospital where casualties were taken, Dr. Atef Al-Ghalat, said hundreds were wounded or killed, but he did not provide exact figures. Neither side's account could be independently confirmed. The strike underlined the anticipated surge in casualties as Israeli troops battling Hamas militants advanced deeper into the northern Gaza Strip toward dense residential neighborhoods. Israel has vowed to crush Hamas' ability to govern Gaza or threaten Israel after its October 7 rampage, which ignited the war. Israel said two of its soldiers were killed in fighting in northern Gaza, the first military deaths it reported since the ground offensive into the tiny Mediterranean territory accelerated last week. Several hundred thousand Palestinians remain in northern Gaza in the path of the ground assault. They crowded into homes or are packed by the thousands in hospitals, already overwhelmed with patients and running low on supplies. In the Jabalia refugee camp, a densely built-up area of small streets on Gaza City's outskirts, footage of the scene from Al Jazeera TV showed at least four large craters where buildings once stood amid a large swath of rubble surrounded by partially collapsed structures. Dozens of rescue workers and bystanders dug through the wreckage, searching for survivors beneath the flattened buildings. Young men carried the limp forms of two children from the upper floors of a damaged apartment block's crumbling frame. While helping down another child and woman, it was unclear whether the children were alive or dead. Brigadier General Daniel Hagari said an underground Hamas installation beneath a targeted building collapsed, toppling other nearby buildings. He said the commander killed in the strike, Ibrahim Biari, played a role in the October 7 attack on Israel. Also on Tuesday, the Israeli military said ground troops took control of a Hamas military stronghold in West Jabalia, killing 50 militants. Hamas spokesman Hazim Qassem denied the military's claim, saying it was trying to justify its heinous crime against civilians. Hagari repeated calls for civilians to evacuate northern Gaza to the south. The military says it targets Hamas fighters and infrastructure, and that the militants endanger civilians by operating among them. Some 800,000 Palestinians reportedly fled to the south, but many have not, in part because they say nowhere is safe, as Israeli airstrikes in the south have continued to cause civilian deaths. The window to flee may be closing as Israel forces reached Gaza's main north-south highway this week. More than 8,500 Palestinians have been killed in the war, mostly women and minors, the Gaza Health Ministry said Tuesday. The figure is without precedent in decades of Israeli-Palestinian violence. Over 1,400 people have died on the Israeli side, mainly civilians, killed during Hamas' initial attack, also an unprecedented figure. Palestinian militants also abducted about 240 people during their incursion, and have continued firing rockets into Israel. A day after Israel's first successful rescue of a captive held by Hamas, the spokesman of the militant group's armed wing said they plan to release some non-Israeli hostages they are holding in the coming days. Hamas previously released 4 hostages and has said it would let the others go in return for thousands of Palestinian prisoners held by Israel, which dismissed the offer. The war also threatens to ignite fighting on other fronts. Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah militant group have traded fire daily along the border, and Israel and the U.S. struck hard targets in Syria linked to Iran, which supports Hamas, Hezbollah, and other armed groups in the region. The military said it shot down what appeared to be a drone near the southernmost city of Eilat and intercepted a missile over the Red Sea on Tuesday, neither of which entered Israeli airspace. Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen later claimed they fired ballistic missiles and drones at Israel, saying it was their third such operation and threatening more. In the occupied West Bank, where Israeli-Palestinian violence also surges, the army demolished the family home of Salah al-Aruri, a senior Hamas official exiled more than a decade ago. An official in the village of Aurora said the home was vacant for 15 years. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says 64 of its staff have been killed since the start of the war, including a man killed alongside his wife and 8 children in a strike late Monday. The other article on the front page is entitled, Federal Reserve Expected to Leave Interest Rate Alone. The Federal Reserve is poised to leave its key interest rate unchanged Wednesday at a time when the Fed faces an economy that has proved resilient but is nevertheless under pressure from surging interest rates, overseas turmoil, and anxious investors. U.S. economic growth surged in the July-September quarter on the back of robust consumer spending, and inflation showed signs last month of staying uncomfortably high. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell will want to make sure that the economy cools and that inflation resumes its descent before signaling any letup in the Fed's drive to slow inflation to its 2% target level. At the same time, turbulent financial markets have pushed up longer-term rates on U.S. Treasuries, driven stock prices lower, and raised corporate borrowing costs. Powell and other Fed policymakers have said they think those trends may contribute to an economic slowdown, and in the process, ease inflation pressures, without the need for further rate hikes. Since March 2022, the Fed raised its key rate from near zero to roughly 5.4% in its effort to tame inflation, which reached a 4-decade high as the economy roared out of the pandemic recession of 2020. The costs of mortgages, auto loans, and credit card debt all rose in response. Annual inflation, as measured by the government's Consumer Price Index, sunk from a 9.1% peak in June of last year to 3.7%. Economists at Wall Street banks estimate that sharp losses in the stock and bond markets over the past few months will have a depressive effect on the economy equal to the impact of 3 or 4 quarter-point rate hikes by the Fed. It's clearly a tightening in financial conditions, Powell said this month. That's exactly what we're trying to achieve. Though the Fed raised its benchmark rate to a 22-year high, it hasn't imposed any hikes since July. Even so, the yield, or interest rate, on the 10-year Treasury note has kept rising, hitting 5% last week, a level it hadn't reached in 16 years. The surge in Treasury yields caused the average 30-year fixed mortgage rate to reach almost 8%, and it's also raised the cost of credit cards, auto loans, and many forms of business borrowing. Market analysts say an array of factors combined to force up Treasury yields. For one thing, the government is expected to sell potentially trillions of dollars more in bonds in the coming years to finance huge and persistent budget deficits, even as the Fed is shrinking its holdings of bonds. As a result, higher Treasury rates may be needed to attract more buyers. With the future path of rates murkier than usual, investors are demanding higher yields in return for the greater risk of holding longer-term bonds. What's important for the Fed is that the yield on the 10-year Treasury has continued to zoom higher even without rate hikes by the central bank. That suggests that Treasury yields may stay unusually high even if the Fed keeps its own benchmark rate on hold. Many business and consumer loan rates might, in turn, also stay high, helping keep a lid on economic growth and inflation. Wall Street traders foresee a 98% profit probability that the Fed will leave interest rates unchanged Wednesday, according to the CME FedWatch tool, and they envision only a 24% chance of a rate hike at the Fed's following meeting in December. Powell and other policymakers are hoping to continue making progress toward a so-called soft landing, in which they would succeed in slowing inflation to 2% without causing a deep recession. Inflation has tumbled from its highs, even though hiring has stayed robust. Consumers are spending freely, and the economy is growing at a solid pace, confounding expectations among many economists that a recession would likely be necessary to make much progress. The story of the year so far, economists at Goldman Sachs wrote, has been that economic reacceleration has not prevented further progress in the inflation fight. Yet the upending of those traditional relationships also posed a challenge for the Fed's policymakers. They are now proceeding without much guidance from their workhorse economic model, known as the Phillips curve. Under that economic model, conquering inflation generally requires much higher unemployment and slower growth, even a recession. Alan Blinder, a Princeton University economist who was the Fed's vice chair from 1994 to 1996, said last week that those relationships were upended by COVID-19 and left the Fed with less clear guidance to set policy. The pandemic changed everything, he said. At the Fed during the 1990s, Blinder said, we used to lean on the Phillips curve in assessing inflation trends. That's a gigantic difference between then and now. On page 2, news from the Department of Justice. The article is entitled, DOJ Takes on JetBlue-Spirit Merger. The Biden administration's fight against consolidation in the airline industry was tested Tuesday as lawyers for JetBlue Airways and the Justice Department squared off in court. The administration is suing to block JetBlue's proposed $3.8 billion acquisition of Spirit Airlines. The trial in federal district court in Boston could reshape the market for low-cost airlines. Spirit is by far the nation's biggest budget carrier, and it will disappear if JetBlue wins the case. As the trial began with opening statements from lawyers for both sides, shares of JetBlue were suffering their worst one-day drop in more than 3 years, after the airline reported a wider loss than expected in the third quarter and predicted another surprisingly large loss for the fourth quarter. Executives declined to take questions about the Spirit deal. CEO Robin Hayes said it would be inappropriate while the matter was being debated in court. The Justice Department is fresh off a victory in a previous lawsuit that killed a partnership between JetBlue and American Airlines. JetBlue isn't exactly the sort of behemoth that comes to mind when imagining a defendant in an antitrust case. It is the sixth largest U.S. airline by revenue, and it is trying to buy the seventh biggest. If it swallows Spirit, JetBlue will leapfrog Alaska Airlines, but still control less than 10% of the U.S. air travel market. It would remain far smaller than American, United, Delta, or Southwest. But if JetBlue gets its way, it will grow its fleet about 70%, repaint Spirit's yellow planes, and make them less cramped inside. The New York carrier argues that it needs Spirit to bulk up and compete better against the bigger airlines. JetBlue touts itself as one of the most disruptive and innovative companies in the history of the airline industry, and says it can bring down fares if it can go head-to-head against the Big Four on more routes. The Justice Department argues, however, that Spirit is the disruptive force that needs to be protected. Consumers are better off with an independent Spirit, not a JetBlue intent on removing seats from planes and charging higher fares, government lawyers argued in their pretrial brief. They say the harm will fall hardest on cost-conscious customers. JetBlue says the vacuum left by Spirit would be filled by growth from other discount airlines. The Justice Department says that is unlikely because all airlines, including the budget carriers, face limits to growth, including shortages of planes and pilots. Spirit, which is based in Miramar, Florida, is known as an ultra-low-cost carrier, the name given to airlines that tout rock-bottom fares but make up for it by charging high fees for things like checking a bag or carrying one on board. Spirit even charges for soft drinks. Personal finance site NerdWallet said passengers should expect to pay $137 in fees on a typical one-way flight, compared with $35 or less at the bigger airlines, including JetBlue. This isn't the first time that the government has challenged an airline merger. In 2013, regulators sued to stop the merger of American Airlines and U.S. Airways. The deal, which created the world's biggest carrier, went through without a trial, however, after the airlines agreed to give up some gates and takeoff and landing rights at seven major airports. JetBlue tried that strategy. It offered to divest gates and landing and takeoff rights and gates in Boston, the New York City area, and Fort Lauderdale, Florida, to Frontier and Allegiant. The government scoffed at the offer, saying those discount carriers have pledged to fly the same routes that Spirit flies now. The Biden administration may be having remorse for mergers that the Obama administration allowed to go through and which eliminated Northwest, Continental, U.S. Airways, and AirTran as competitors to the four largest U.S. airlines. Before the current case, the Justice Department sued to quash a JetBlue-American partnership in which they shared revenue from flights in New York and Boston. The new trial is taking place in the same Boston courthouse where the Justice Department prevailed against JetBlue and American, but the case is being heard by a different judge. It is expected to last until early December. In New York on Tuesday, executives of JetBlue Airways Corp. blamed bad weather in September, air traffic control problems, and rising fuel prices for the company's $153 million loss in the third quarter, a wider loss than expected. In national and world news, an article from Congress entitled "Leaders Advocate for Aid." The administration wants $105 billion, largely to spend on conflicts abroad. The nation's top military and diplomatic leaders urged an increasingly divided Congress on Tuesday to send immediate aid to Israel and Ukraine, arguing at a Senate hearing that broad support for the assistance would signal U.S. strength to adversaries worldwide. The testimony from Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Secretary of State Antony Blinken to the Senate Appropriations Committee came as the administration's massive $105 billion emergency aid request for conflicts in the two countries encountered roadblocks. While there is bipartisan support in the Democratic-led Senate for aid to both Ukraine and Israel, the request faces deep problems in the Republican-led House. New Speaker Mike Johnson proposed focusing on Israel alone and slashing money for the Internal Revenue Service to pay for it. As the congressional divisions deepen, Blinken and Austin warned that the consequences of failing to help Ukraine in its war with Russia and Israel as it strikes back against Hamas would be dire. Inaction, they said, would threaten the security of the U.S. and the rest of the world. We now stand at a moment where many are again making the bet that the United States is too divided or distracted at home to stay the course, Blinken said. That is what is at stake. Austin said that if the United States fails to lead, the cost and the threats to the United States will only grow. We must not give our friends, our rivals, or our foes any reason to doubt America's resolve. President Joe Biden requested $14.3 billion for Israel, $61.4 billion to support Ukraine, $9.1 billion for humanitarian efforts in Gaza and elsewhere, and $7.4 billion for the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. is focused on countering China's influence. Some of the Ukraine funding would go toward replenishing domestic stockpiles of weapons that already were provided. The White House also requested about $14 billion to protect the southern U.S. border. That money would be used to boost the number of border agents, install new inspection machines to detect fentanyl, and to increase staffing for processing asylum cases. But the House is trying to set aside much of Biden's request for now to focus on a package of about $14.5 billion for Israel. That plan faced immediate resistance among Senate Democrats and put pressure on the Senate Republicans, who support the Ukraine aid but are conscious of growing concerns about it within their party. And now an article from Kathmandu, Nepal, regarding UN Chief Guterres visits Nepal. He speaks before Parliament, warns of melting glacial ice. The UN chief said Tuesday, after touring the highest peaks in Nepal, that the world should end the fossil fuel age to curb what he says is a devastating level of melting of glaciers in the Himalayan mountains due to global warming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressed Nepal's parliament after flying past Mount Everest, the world's highest peak, on Monday and touring the base camp of Mount Annapurna, the world's 10th highest, on Tuesday. Glaciers are melting at records. I was a witness, Guterres said in his address. The effect is devastating. Swollen lakes bursting, rivers and seas rising, cultures threatened, and mountainsides exposed, inflaming the risk of rock slides, landslides, and avalanche. Guterres visited towns including Pokhara, where trekkers begin journeys in the Mount Annapurna region, and met with local groups to discuss environmental issues, including protecting the Himalayan glaciers that provide fresh water to more than a billion people. I am here today to cry out from the rooftop of the world, stop the madness, Guterres said. The glaciers are retreating, but we cannot, he said. We must end the fossil age. A report this year by the Nepal-based International Center for Integrated Mountain Development said Himalayan glaciers could lose up to 80% of their volume if the Earth warms by 4 degrees Celsius in coming decades or centuries. Guterres urged countries to stick to commitments under the 2015 Paris Climate Conference to control carbon emissions to keep warming down. We must act now to protect people on the front line and to limit global temperatures rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius, Guterres said. Scientists warn that flash floods and avalanches could become more likely in coming years, in part due to climate change. Guterres also appealed to the international community to donate funding to help build resilience in affected communities. And now to Maine, where affidavits detail possible motive in the Maine shooting. Gunman thought others accused him of being a pedophile. Maine state police documents released Tuesday shed light on why a delusional U.S. Army reservist who killed 18 people may have targeted a bowling alley and a bar in Lewiston. Robert Card, 40, was found dead on Friday, 2 days after a rampage that also wounded 13 people and shut down multiple communities during a massive manhunt. 3 hours after the shooting began, state police interviewed a woman who said Card believed the just-in-time recreation bowling alley, Shumenji's Bar and Grill, and several other businesses were broadcasting online that Robert was a pedophile. The woman said Card was delusional since February after a breakup, had been hospitalized for mental illness, and prescribed medication that he stopped taking, according to an affidavit. Card's brother and another man told police Card had been in relationship with someone he met at the bar. Card's son told police paranoia about strangers calling him a pedophile became a recurring theme for his father since last winter. Children in and around Lewiston were back in school and went trick-or-treating Tuesday after last week's lockdown. And now to Ukraine, where we find an article, UN probe faults Russia in October 5 missile attack. Strike hit Ukrainian village, killing dozens of civilians at a wake. UN investigators on Tuesday urged Russia to acknowledge responsibility for a missile strike on a Ukrainian village that killed 59 civilians, conduct a transparent investigation into what happened, provide reparations for victims, and hold those responsible to account. The strike on a cafe in the village of Rosa on October 5 was one of the deadliest strikes since the Kremlin's forces launched a full-scale invasion 20 months ago. Whole families perished while they attended a wake for a local soldier who died fighting Russian troops. The blast killed 36 women, 22 men, and an 8-year-old boy. The Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine said in a report published Tuesday it has reasonable grounds to believe that a Russian Iskander missile, a short-range precision-guided ballistic weapon, probably caused the blast in Rosa. It said that Russia either failed to undertake all feasible measures to verify that the intended target was a military objective rather than civilians or civilian objects, or deliberately targeted civilians or a civilian object. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for November 1, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Messenger for November 1, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. On the front page today, the lead article is entitled Curtain to Rise on FDSH Fall Play. Cast crew overcame adversity. The old saying in entertainment is the show must go on. Thanks to some dedicated parents, staff, and students, the Fort Dodge Senior High School fall play will definitely go on starting this Thursday in the Gail Neiswanger Little Theater. This year's play, Once Upon a Fairy, will have performances at 7 p.m. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Tickets are $6 each and will be available at the doors. No activities passes can be used. This year's production has been a unique one. Advisor Lindy Krog had to deal with the death of her father, longtime Fort Dodge teacher, and coach Bob Breffley, who passed away on October 26. He was in hospice for a while before his death, taking Krug away from the cast and crew. But she said they didn't miss a beat while she was gone. "I needed to make the choice to be with him, obviously," said Krug, "because I have an amazing group of parents and an amazing group of kids and an amazing group of co-workers that all said, 'How can I help and what can I do?' It kept us going." Krug said the play itself is a typical fairy tale, complete with two sisters who are, of course, opposites. One becomes a queen and the other becomes a witch, which she didn't get since she didn't get the throne. The queen dies, and her daughter can only take the crown after meeting her handsome prince. But her aunt, the witch, puts a spell on her that makes the daughter a royal pain in the butt, so no one will marry her. Suitors line up to meet her, then find out they don't really want to end up with her. The cast includes more than 36 students. Krug's assistant director is Deidre Miller Clay. There will also be opening and intermission music by senior Evan Pratt. "Theater is my passion, and any time I can be involved in it, it is good," said Krug. "But even more so right now, it provides me with some catharsis and a happy place. This is my happy place, this theater and these kids. They have helped me with all my emotions." Krug said they are down to the last-minute details. A couple costumes arrived Monday, and programs were printed Tuesday. She said a lot of people stepped up to make sure everything that needed to get done was finished. Things were a little stressful last Thursday and Friday without Krug, but Mrs. Miller Clay was an amazing help at that time, said senior Sydney Gebbers, who has the role of narrator too for the play. "People were trying their best to give back to everyone, causing lots of loud voices, but Mrs. Miller Clay was able to calm us all down and get us to listen to one voice. This is my first fall play on stage, and everyone has stepped up this year," she added. "Everyone has put lots of time and effort into this play, so I'm excited to see the audience's reaction." Also on the front page is an article entitled, "Another Buena Vista Turkey Flock Infected by Bird Flu." A commercial turkey flock of about 30,000 birds in Buena Vista County was recently infected by a highly transmissible avian influenza and will be culled, according to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. It is the fourth detection of the virus this fall in domestic bird flocks in Iowa and the second in Buena Vista County. The virus is predominantly spread by migrating birds and is often deadly to chicken and turkey flocks. Those with confirmed infections are destroyed to prevent further spread from flock to flock. It's unclear yet whether the virus was transmitted between the two Buena Vista flocks because lab tests are pending, said Don McDowell, an IDALS spokesperson. The first virus detection in that county was in a flock of 50,000 turkeys on October 20. The two other virus detections were confirmed October 23 in a commercial turkey flock in Pocahontas County and a backyard flock in Guthrie County. The virus has also been found in more than a dozen commercial turkey flocks with more than 600,000 birds in Minnesota and South Dakota, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Iowa is particularly susceptible to significant bird losses because of its large chicken egg-laying operations, which can have millions of birds. About 16 million birds were culled in Iowa last year because of the virus. Most of those were the result of detections during the spring migration, but this year there was just one detection during the spring in a backyard flock in Chickasaw County. And finally, on the front page, we take center stage with Evan Pratt, article entitled Strumming Along. Love of Music Guides Pratt Onto the Stage. Growing up, music was always playing in the background at Evan Pratt's house. A variety of tunes helped set the tone for his self-made music career. Pratt always loved a wide variety of songs and instruments as a young boy. After the purchase of a guitar a few years ago, his drive to perform really accelerated. I bought a guitar right before the COVID-19 pandemic in early 2020 because I was just beginning to dive into older music and it was featured in many songs that I enjoyed listening to, Pratt said. I didn't truly start learning until I owned it for a few months. Then I decided I was going to finally figure it out on my own. There was quite a big learning curve, but eventually, and without even really being aware of it, I made it through the tough part and became confident in my playing. Music has always heavily influenced Pratt's daily activity and lifestyle. Ever since I can remember, my parents have been playing music in the house. As I grew up, I enjoyed listening to music any chance I got, Pratt said. I really started to get into it when I got my own iPod, because I could make my own playlists and find new songs. At that point, I was playing in the middle school band, and although I didn't stick it out, I really enjoyed playing with a large group of kids and making fun music. The music that the Fort Dodge Senior High School senior listened to, anywhere from the radio to YouTube, was something he loved, but he also wanted to make something original. He started writing his own songs not long after honing his skills on the guitar. I really enjoyed the music I listened to. I wanted to both replicate it and create my own, Pratt said. Creating music is something I've always found interesting, so I decided I was going to take action and start learning more. I didn't really get good at the guitar until maybe a year and a half into owning it. It took a long time and a lot of work for me to learn the basics and even longer to become very confident in my playing abilities. Once it became second nature, Pratt started sharing his talents in Fort Dodge and communities around the area. He opens for other regional music acts while also playing his own sets from time to time. I've always enjoyed performing for others, but sharing my own creations and renditions of songs was something that really clicked with me. In his 4 years as a Dodger, Pratt has been actively involved in clubs and organizations well beyond music. He has been a member of the Dodger Senate for 4 years and is currently FDSH's student body president. On stage, he has participated in the fall play, musical, speech, and choir. He also involved in the Little Dodger, varsity golf, and the Skills USA competition. I believe my passion for acting stemmed from loving movies throughout my life. Just like music, movies were a thing my family and I watched a lot growing up, and that always seemed fun to me, Pratt said. In my early middle school years, I joined an acting club and enjoyed all my time spent there. Due to playing baseball, I unfortunately could never really get involved in the Stage Door summer productions in Fort Dodge. So when the musical in seventh grade rolled around, I was very eager to join. Just like his music, performing on stage was a chance for Pratt to share his own story while connecting with the crowd. I enjoy performing for people and telling a story, Pratt said, making the audience feel the emotions I have felt when listening to songs or watching movies or productions. Whether it be a comedic performance in a play or a sad song, emotions are so interesting to try and recreate, connect, and capture. Being a part of student government allowed Pratt to help make a difference on behalf of his classmates. Going into high school, I had heard a lot about student government and figured it would be interesting to be part of decisions to help make the school a better place, Pratt said. I didn't really care if I was helping to bring back a certain cookie in the cafeteria or decorating for Christmas. It all seemed important in its own way and has all been very enjoyable. As his time winds down at FDSH, it's not always about the big moments or the memorable experiences. Little pieces bring everything together for Pratt. I think the stuff that I'll miss the most will be the stuff I don't really realize yet, Pratt said. Little details, like random people you have conversations with, and the variety that different classes bring to each day. I really enjoyed my last golf season. The team environment was awesome, and I got to see some really good young golfers for us that I can continue to follow in the coming years. Finding and trying new things at FDSH has always been one of Pratt's main priorities. I liked to stay involved, to meet new people, and experience new things, Pratt said. Your future job might stem from a random class you sign up for and find out you actually enjoy. Or your future best friend could be a kid who you do an activity with during your freshman year. Pratt also shared his voice in choir and during FDSH's musicals. I view both choir and acting as a medium to convey emotion, whether it be happy or sad, and I always aim to have the audience share in those feelings, Pratt said. Being a part of 2 years of musical performances with so many talented people has been truly incredible. After high school, Pratt will attend Iowa Central Community College. He plans on continuing to play music and working on cars in his free time. On the opinion page, we have a Messenger editorial entitled Events Offer Opportunity to Support Community Causes. Book sale, Night for LifeWorks, are this week. A couple of special events this week offer a chance to support worthy causes in Fort Dodge. One of them provides a chance to get good books at great prices, while the other offers an evening of music and fun. The one that offers lots and lots of books is already underway. It is the Autumn Book Sale conducted by the Friends of the Fort Dodge Public Library. Sale hours are 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. today, Thursday and Friday, plus 9 a.m. to noon Saturday. On Friday, anything that will fit in a bag will cost $3. On Saturday, a bag of books will cost $1. There are tables stretching the length of the library's big meeting room, and they are covered with books for sale. There are even some books still in boxes beneath the tables. Something to satisfy just about any reading taste can be found on those tables. There is a particularly good selection of history books at this sale. Purchasing some used books does more than just give the buyer good reading for a lazy weekend afternoon. Those purchases also help the Friends of the Library generate the money to pay for new materials and programs for the library. With the city's general fund budget seemingly always getting tighter, those investments by the Friends Group are important. The group pays for most, if not all, of the new materials, while the city pays for the building upkeep and the staff salaries. The Night of Music and Fun will be on Thursday. It's called A Night for LifeWorks, and it supports a local organization that serves the disabled. It starts at 5 p.m. at Fort Frenzy. The event's format is a musical talent show similar to those seen on TV. The competitors will be Alicia Smith, Brady O'Brien, and Chris Carr. The judges will be Sheriff Luke Fleener, Fire Chief Steve Hergenreeder, and Police Chief Dennis Quinn. The night will also feature dinner and an auction. All the money generated at the event will go for the LifeWorks Charitable Foundation, which supports LifeWorks Community Services. LifeWorks has an outstanding reputation for serving our friends and neighbors who need some extra support as they strive to live life to their fullest potential. The organization is worthy of broad support. We encourage everyone to check out the book sale and A Night for LifeWorks. In fact, on Thursday, you can do both in the same day. But no matter when you go, you will be supporting worthwhile causes, and the benefits for you will be listening to good music and getting some good books to read during the coming cold, dark days. On page 5, we find a brief article entitled House Speaker Mike Johnson Was Once the Dean of a Christian Law School, It Never Opened Its Doors. Before House Speaker Mike Johnson was elected to public office, he was the dean of a small Baptist law school that didn't exist. The establishment of the Judge Paul Pressler School of Law was supposed to be a capstone achievement for Louisiana College, which administrators boasted would unashamedly embrace a biblical worldview. Instead, it collapsed roughly a decade ago without enrolling students or opening its doors amid infighting by officials, accusation of financial impropriety, and difficulty obtaining accreditation, which frightened away would-be donors. There is no indication that Johnson engaged in wrongdoing while employed by the private college, now known as Louisiana Christian University. But as a virtually unknown player in Washington, the episode offers insight into how Johnson navigated leadership challenges that echo the chaos, feuding, and hard-right politics that have come to define the Republican House majority he now leads. The chapter is just the latest to surface since the four-term congressman's improbable election as Speaker last week, following the ouster of former Speaker Kevin McCarthy, a reminder of his long-standing ties to the Christian right, which is now a dominant force in GOP politics. And now it's time to turn to some sports. On Iowa football, an article headlined Uncharted Move, Mid-season announcement rarity at Iowa. Kirk Ferentz's long-standing philosophy has been to evaluate the various facets of his Iowa football program at the end of each season. Interim athletic director Beth Goetz took matters into her own hands and did a mid-season assessment of one of the 25th-year coach's staff members, announcing offensive coordinator Brian Ferentz would be out in 2024. Kirk Ferentz deflected most questions Tuesday about his son's looming removal, but indicated he was not on board with the timing of the announcement. He said the end of the season is a better time for making decisions because less emotion is involved. "I can give you a lot of reasons why I've done it that way, but it really doesn't matter," he said. "It's really not significant right now because we're dealing with something that we have to deal with, and we will." Iowa ranks 133rd and last in the bowl subdivision in total offense. The Hawkeyes are 108th in rushing, 128th in passing, and 118th in scoring. Goetz made her decision during Iowa's off week following a 12-10 home loss to Minnesota, in which the Hawkeyes had just 12 second-half yards. Neither Kirk Ferentz nor Goetz, who met with reporters after the coach's weekly news conference, would get into the details of the decision or its timeline. "Those are private conversations," Goetz said. "We're going to keep it that way." Asked when he was notified of Goetz's decision, Ferentz said, "I had access to the announcement that you read, that we all read over the weekend." Brian Ferentz, who will remain at the offensive coordinator for the rest of the season, has been working under a revised contract that required Iowa to average 25 points per game and win seven games, or the contract would be terminated. Kirk Ferentz said it served no purpose to discuss the mandate now. "Brian is the one who signed it, and I think he thought it was the best option available, and I would have co-signed it, not that it was my business," the head coach said. Goetz declined comment on the conditions of the contract. "What you do is you look at what's right in front of you, and you take that information, what you can navigate, and you make the best decisions that you can," she said. Goetz has been Brian Ferentz's direct supervisor, because of university nepotism regulations. She said she was not pressured from anyone outside the program to make the decision. I think anytime you're in a situation like these, you tune out what's around, she said. The hiring of a new offensive coordinator will be done by Kirk Ferentz at the end of the season, Gutz said. Just like with any of our sports and any of our coaches, we empower our head coaches to make decisions that they think are best in the hiring process, she said. And of course, administrators are involved in how we engage with them and exchange ideas, but those are decisions that we'll leave up to the coach. Kirk Ferentz said his immediate focus is on the next four games, starting Saturday against Northwestern at Chicago's Wrigley Field. The Hawkeyes are 6-2 overall and in a four-way tie for first place in the Big Ten West at 3-2. Iowa, which has had one of the nation's worst offenses for 3 years, was hoping for a revival when quarterback Cade McNamara transferred from Michigan in the offseason. But McNamara is out for the season with a knee injury. Injuries also have ended the seasons of tight ends Luke Lachey and Eric All, who have combined for 31 receptions this season. Asked what could have been done differently on offense this season, Kirk Ferentz said, yeah, kept everybody healthy. Again, you can't play that game. It is what it is. We're where we are at, and we're moving forward. That's all you can do. And now some World Series news. Texas powers past Arizona. From Phoenix, Marcus Semien's two-run triple and three-run homer powered Texas to a 10-run lead by the third inning. Corey Seager hit another long home run, and the Rangers beat the Arizona Diamondbacks 11-7 on Tuesday night to move ahead 3-1 at the World Series. Rangers batters whipped through Diamondbacks pitching like a desert storm, taking a 10-0 lead and becoming the first team in series history with five consecutive five-run innings. First team in world in series history with consecutive five-run innings. Seager's third two-run homer in the series capped the second. Semien's drive punctuated the third, and Jonah Heim added an eighth-inning shot. Texas improved to a record of 10-0 on the road this postseason and moved within one win of the first title in the 63-season history of the franchise that started as the expansion Washington Senators in 1961. Ethan Evolde tries to close out the third all-wildcard series on Wednesday night against Zach Gallen in a rematch of Game 1 starters. 42 of 49 previous teams to take 3-1 leads have gone on to win the World Series. The most recent club to overcome a 3-1 deficit was the Chicago Cubs against Cleveland in 2016. Texas scored its first 10 runs with two outs, batting an Arizona staff that needed four pitchers to get its first eight outs. Miguel Castro's wild pitch brought home the first run, and an error by Gold Glove first baseman Christian Walker, the first by either team in the series, led to five unearned runs in the third. Seager and Semien, all-star middle infielders, signed as free agents for $500 million combined before the 2022 season, have six RBIs each in the series. Seager, the first shortstop with three series homers, has four homers in his last five games dating to the AL Championship Series. After leading the Los Angeles Dodgers to the 2020 title, he could join Sandy Koufax, Bob Gibson, and Reggie Jackson as the only two-time World Series MVPs. Travis Jankowski, replacing injured slugger Adolis Garcia in right field, singled in the second and hit a two-run double in the third in his first series at-bats. Andrew Haney, a 32-year-old lefty with his fifth big league team, got the win by allowing four hits in five innings. Six relievers followed, with closer Jose Leclerc getting the final out. Lourdes Gurriel Jr. hit a sacrifice fly in the fourth for Arizona and a three-run homer in the eighth against Chris Stratton. Tommy Pham had a sacrifice fly in the eighth, and Gabriel Moreno had a two-run single in the ninth. There was a festive mood at Chase Field, where the roof was open for the second straight night. Some fans arrived in Halloween costumes, but many started booing in the second inning. With both teams short on starting pitching, they each planned to string together bullpen games in what Arizona manager Torey Lovullo termed a chess match he looked forward to. For Arizona, it was a gambit that failed. And now we'll take a little brief look at obituaries in today's paper. First is Jim Olson, James Olson formerly, age 71, of Colville, passed away on Sunday, October 29, 2023, at Trinity Regional Medical Center. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. on Friday, November 3, 2023, at Trinity United Methodist Church, with military honors presented by the U.S. Army and local VFW Post 1856. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. on Friday, prior to the service at the church. Arrangements have been entrusted with Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services.